You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. Now, these are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello, and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports. I am Neil Payne. I'm a sports writer here at 538, and I'll be hosting this week once more as our regular host Chad Matlin is away yet again. Who the heck knows what he's doing? But we do have one familiar face on the line. It's Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist, and she's calling in this week from what's the magical location this week, Kate?
Well, hi, Neil. The magical location is upstate New York, which sounds pleasant, but I am sitting outside of a hospital. My dad is fine, but he had to have neck surgery so he can get back out on the basketball court as quickly as possible.
Ooh, bad news. Hopefully he can get out there. What position does he play? What's his game like?
He plays small forward. Normally he's 60 years old. He still plays twice a week, and he's a ridiculously good outside shooter. So we're hoping now with the neck surgery – I'm assuming that somehow he'll come back better than ever at age 60.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what Peyton Manning did, a different sport, obviously, but he had neck surgery, so I think it'll be the same.
Nice. In fact, the injury is the same.
Is it really?
Wow. I'm not sure he's going to come back the same as Peyton Manning because I think he's a little older than Peyton, but it is the same surgery.
Wow. Well, best of luck to him. And also, I should mention, it sounds like there are some birds in the background. Can you explain a little about that, Kate?
Well, I figured that to tape Hot Takedown outside in the sun with the birds chirping was better than like in the waiting area of a hospital. And I figured all our listeners would second that choice.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, it's adding a much needed kind of uplifting atmosphere, as putting the hospital part aside at least. And also to continue our run of great guests in Chad's absence, we've got Justin Tinsley. He's a culture and sports writer for The Undefeated, and he's coming to us on the line from D.C., right?
That'd be correct, man. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. Welcome to the show, Justin.
I'm looking forward to it. I know I got a lot to live up to, so hopefully I don't drop the ball here.
Well,
it's good to have you, Justin.
The comparison point is Chad, so you don't have that much to live up to.
If you just speak words out loud, you're going to be fine.
and what kind of animal life do you have in the background, or is it kind of quiet there?
Well, I hope I have no animal life behind me because I'm in a studio. So if an animal is in here, you may hear some words that you might have to bleep out.
Okay, so hopefully one of us has animals and two of us don't on the show. In any event, here's what we have on the show today. First of all, the Cavs shocked or at least mildly surprised the world Monday night. They beat the Warriors in Oakland, a place where the Warriors had been previously pretty unbeatable. Now the series is going back to Cleveland, so do LeBron and company really have a shot at this thing? And would we be talking about a back-to-back champion this morning if Draymond Green had not been suspended for Game 5? Then we'll say goodbye to the 2016 NHL season with Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post. The Pittsburgh Penguins hoisted Lord Stanley's Cup Sunday night. Were they the better team by the advanced metrics, though? Did Sid the Kid deserve the Conn Smythe Trophy, and are the Pens here to stay as a dominant power in the NHL? The other Neil, not me, will fill us in. And finally, Justin will discuss his undefeated story about a champion dethroned, how the 1971 Howard University soccer team were unfairly stripped of a national championship. And then, of course, we'll bring the Sig Dig, which is a telling number from the world of sports, which Justin will kindly provide as the guest of honor on the show today.
Looking forward to that.
So first, let's talk about the NBA Finals. A week ago in this space, we ran a really hot take in which a guy was disgusted and appalled and mortified with the Cavs play or something like that. This week, it's the Warriors' turn. So here's Michael Smith on ESPN's His and Hers telling us the Warriors need to step up their game.
This loosey-goosey, relaxed Warriors, yeah, we got this. This is so close to being a collapse. It's too close for comfort. I'm not saying they should be losing sleeping in the fetal position tonight, but to say that they should not be nervous at all, in the back of their minds, they got to be thinking, yo, man, it's time to stop fooling around here. We can't fool around with this thing.
Okay, so what is wrong with the Warriors? Was it a case of them not taking things seriously enough, or is it just because Draymond Green was not in the lineup for Game 5?
Well, I couldn't help but, Neil, think about how a lot of the really interesting statistics have come out during this postseason as we discussed Steph Curry's injury and whether or not, right, is he playing injured and how important injuries are to potential NBA champions. And there, those numbers were like, you know, in the last 30 years, only two teams, the Chicago Bulls were missing Tony Kukoc for a couple games, and then the 2012 Miami Heat were missing Chris Bosh for, I think it was six games. Only, like, those two potential, those two eventual champions, like, missed star players or key players for any of the NBA postseason. So I bring this up only because I think you saw, like, Draymond Green being out last night, even though it's not an injury, it's still part of this phenomenon that, like, NBA champions really are just the team that stays healthy and doesn't miss players, more so than necessarily, you know, they're absolutely always the absolute best team in the league. So I think some of what's going on with the Warriors last night is, like, you're in this, like, key moment, in absolute key moment in your season. You take out a guy that, right, had never been taken out of the lineup before. I think he was a part of all 88 Warriors wins going into last night's game. And, like, they've missed Steph before. They've missed other players before. Maybe Draymond Green's a guy that they just don't – they didn't know yet how to not play with.
Right. We looked at the numbers and today at 538, and we saw that Green was the second best player, according to the advanced stats, to miss a finals game since 1984. So Magic Johnson in 1989 was the only guy who was better than Draymond Green to miss a game in the finals.
That's an incredible stat. When just hearing you say that, I would have never considered that, but it makes total sense. And Kate mentioned it. I think, you know, if Draymond misses a game in January or February, you really don't notice because there's always like 60 other games going on any given night. Maybe not 60. I'm just spitballing off the top of my head. But when you take him out of a game such as this, obviously everything is intensified. The playoffs are intensified and the finals are just a totally different beast altogether. So, Draymond missing last game, missing, you know, game five, was obviously a huge factor into the outcome of the game, but I also don't want to take away from, you know, what the Cavs did last night. And honestly, you know, I don't think what Draymond did warranted a suspension, but, you know, when you're under a, you know, don't mess up policy, when you're on probation, anything you do can get you, you know, caught up. And I can't feel bad for Draymond in that regard, because you can't react, because that's what LeBron wanted him to do. It was clear as day he wanted him to react. So, yeah, they missed him last night, but I don't know if it would have had as much of an outcome last night, especially with the way LeBron and Kyrie were shooting.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to talk about was just to go back to what we said at the top of the show about, like, would the Warriors have closed it up with Draymond in the lineup, was this idea of, you know, no sport probably do people love the conspiracy theory more than in the NBA. We have the frozen envelope for the draft, and we have, you know, all of these other things, the secret suspension, and I don't know if I'm actually even allowed to mention these things on air, so people can look these up. But do we think this is another case of, you know, it being in the league's best interest for these to be extended to six games, or is it a case where, you know, nobody would have stopped LeBron and Kyrie Irving the way they were playing last night?
Well, I mean, I obviously feel like and I know all about the conspiracy theories, especially around the NBA draft, but I mean, if you're watching the series or if you're even watching Draymond throughout these playoffs, the fact that he's suspended for game five seems like the right decision when you take the accumulation of everything that's going on. It's really hard to wrap my head around the fact that the people in the NBA are really thinking that they make this call. You know, they shift the odds slightly in the Cavs' favor, because what we saw last night required the first ever 40-plus point game from two players, you know, in an NBA Finals to even advance us to a game six. Tack that on with Steph Curry once again, and I say once again because I don't think really he's played at Steph Curry level for a lot of this NBA Finals and even some of the conference finals. And Neil, I'm wondering kind of what the numbers are, because I'm issuing a slight bit of a hot take here in as I'm watching Steph Curry. This really is the first time, like, where he's had to deal with sort of the same thing LeBron always has to deal with, like, every game LeBron ever plays, which is this swirl of drama kind of around him no matter what. And you've seen, like, in the last couple of weeks, like, Steph, there's, you know, the drama, and again, I know this is a hot take, so Neil, I want you to come in here and set me straight, but, you know, it's like Aisha Curry's issuing tweets, we've got, like, the huge all the meme about the Chef Curry twos. You've got the drama about his injury and then his decision not to play in the Olympics. It feels like for the first time in Steph's career, there's a lot of like off the court drama that he's having to deal with that maybe we hadn't seen earlier in his career. And I think part of it's the injury where we're seeing Steph maybe not play at MVP level like we've seen this season. But I wonder too if this is like, there's a lot going on around him right now.
Right, and there's a lot to unpack in that question too. First of all, Kate, you're a sneakerhead. What did you think about those shoes?
Yeah, I mean, let's get to the heart of the matter. I mean,
the real important stuff.
You know, somebody sent a tweet out talking about like the Curry 2s this year because they've sold really, really well. But when it comes to sneakerheads, somebody was like, look, every sneakerhead I know who has the Curry 2s got them for free. And that's how I have them. I have three pairs of Curry 2s, but I got them all for free. So, and then when I saw the Chef Curry's come out, I was like, those are not ones I'm going to be asking my friend to send me for free.
Don't burn a favor on those.
Yeah, no, you know what? Whatever favor you were thinking of sending me, those don't do it. I'm good.
Man, look, Steph Curry is arguably the best player on the planet, but man, those shoes were his equivalent of the Jordan Cryface. He can drop 60 in them, and I will commend him all day, but that will not make me want to go buy those shoes.
Wow, strong words. In terms of the on-court stuff, just to focus back on that, it's worth saying that he has pulled ahead in the lead of the Warriors, at least in terms of kind of the box score stats, in terms of his production using John Hollinger's game score metric. But he's lagging way behind LeBron. And when we looked at this through three games, it was the worst, pretty much by far the worst three-game performance in the finals by a league MVP. He's played a little bit better since then, but I can't imagine that it ranks anywhere but, you know, near the basement of league MVP performances in the finals through five games. And what's really interesting to me also is that, you know, I don't know who's going to win the finals MVP this year, and there's still some things to be settled. But if it's not Curry, how strange will it be that you'll have had a player win two straight championships, two straight league MVPs, one of which was unanimous, and you know, in the past, when that's happened, it would be unthinkable that when they won the championship, they would not be the league MVP. But what does it say about Curry, or does it say anything about Curry that it's really possible that he might not? He might pull off that rare kind of double and yet still not win the finals MVP either year.
Well, it feels like it says like the opposite of what we talk about around LeBron, that we're totally willing, at this point, although there is some discussion now of like, wow, okay, two straight finals in a row where Curry has underperformed compared to his regular season performance. And yet you're still like, well, if you win the title, all that is a moot point. Whereas around LeBron, it feels like even if he wins a title, if he has a subpar performance, somehow we're still taking a knock at his legacy.
The fact of the matter is, and we've all said it, like LeBron's judged on a different curve than anybody I've ever seen in basketball. Now, put him back in Miami. You remember those 2 years he won the back-to-back MVPs in Miami? Imagine if they still win those titles, but Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh gets finals MVP. We're finding, not we, but, you know, the public at large will find a way to crucify LeBron for that. So I don't want to judge Curry on LeBron's standards because LeBron's standards are so extreme, but people will look at it and say, well, you know, you were the best player for 82 games or however many games you played in the playoffs. But when it came down to the series that actually mattered, were you the best player on the court? I won't look at him differently. Some people will. But at the end of the day, he won't catch anywhere near as much heat as if LeBron would have did that in Miami or something like that. It's just the truth of the matter. I hate making LeBron the barometer, but he's been the barometer ever since September 2003 when he played his first game.
The LeBrometer. I think we've come up with a new nickname. But yeah, I wanted to talk about LeBron too, because like you said, Justin, it does seem to be like this juxtaposition where LeBron, you know, he has many seasons in which he's been the best player in the finals, if not the best player in the playoffs as a whole. In fact, I looked at this a couple days ago and I counted up the number of times that by the consensus of the advanced stats, a player was the best player of the postseason in a given year. And LeBron, if he holds it up this year, and it's looking pretty good, especially after the way he played in Game 5, this would be his eighth time being the best player of a playoff campaign, if you will. And the only other player since 76, I want to say since the merger of the ABA and the NBA, to do that eight times was Michael Jordan. And then it goes to Larry Bird three times, Magic Johnson three times, Shaq three times, Kareem three times, then Tim Duncan twice, and then a bunch of guys with one. So, I mean, we're talking about LeBron being in really, really elite company with this, but the problem is is in those eight where Michael Jordan was the best player of the postseason, he won the championship six times and only failed to win two times. It was some of those early years in which he was being, you know, the Bulls were losing to the Pistons. With LeBron, it's flipped. He's only won the title twice in those years, and if they lose this year, if they don't come back against the Warriors, he'll have lost six times in years that he won, that he led the postseason in, you know, statistical value. And that was something that I wanted to kind of bring to you guys and talk about, this kind of pattern of outstanding individual performance but not being able to win. Is it his teammates? Is it and what does this mean about his legacy? We always love to talk about legacy with guys like LeBron. Is the very fact that we're talking about legacies mean that he's in that conversation, but can he ever actually kind of surpass the people like Jordan if he can't beat them on this kind of ground that we've decided is the important ground, which is the championship tally?
Well, Neil, I'd love to find out what the ELO ratings are for the teams that LeBron has had to face in the NBA Finals versus the teams that Jordan has had to face. I'm not insinuating that I think Jordan got a bunch of pushovers every time he went to the NBA Finals, but it does bear pointing out that every time LeBron has been in the Finals, he's played, not every time, but he's played like the San Antonio Spurs at the height of their power. Now we've got a Golden State Warriors team that some are considering the best ever. So I'd love to see a comparison of the ELO points of his opponents in the Finals as compared to some other guys that we have deemed like right winners and guys who are clutch and stuff like that.
Well, as a matter of fact, Sharon Katz wrote a piece at 538, I think last week, before the finals started, where she looked at the expected win percentage of people who appeared in five or more finals, you know, their expected chance of winning their series on average. And LeBron went into each series on average with only a 39% chance of winning, whereas Michael Jordan went into it with a 66% chance of winning. Tim Duncan, 68%. Bill Russell, 72%. Bob Cousy, 79%. Even Kobe, 69%. Really, the only person that's kind of in the same neighborhood as LeBron is Magic Johnson, who went into each series with a 45% chance on average and won five championships. So Magic is ahead of where he should be. LeBron is a little bit below where he should be. But yeah, that's a great point, Kate.
I was actually looking up the numbers again last night, and they support exactly what you said. When you look at his numbers this year, and he's leading the series in minutes played. He's leading the series. He's 1 point behind Kyrie in total points in the series. He's leading the series in rebounds, assists, and unfortunately, he's leading it over in turnovers, too. But he's also tied for first in steals and blocks. Like, his imprint on the game is just undeniable, and he's done it for years. I mean, you just said it yourself. Now, his two and four record in the finals, Kate just nailed it again. I believe that's really a victim of who he's faced. He's played the Spurs three times, and they traditionally been called the best franchise in sports since the Jordan dynasty. You know, they've won 50 games every year that they possibly could, you know, sans a lockout season. He played a great young Oklahoma City team, which he won. The only finals I really think that you can put on LeBron's shoulders is like, hey, if you would have done a little bit more, maybe you could have got a victory, is the 2011 finals versus Dallas.
Okay, so let's look ahead, having said that, to Game 6. It's going to be in Cleveland. That's a good point for the Cavs. Draymond Green is back. That's bad for the Cavs. That's good for the Warriors. Our ELO system has the Cavs favored to win, 59% chance, but the Warriors are still favored to win the series. I'd love to hear what you guys think about, you know, predictions for the rest of the series. Do you think that the Cavs can get it at home? And even if they do they stand a chance in Game 7?
I mean, at this point, it's kind of like you have to go with the numbers, because this whole postseason has felt like an exercise in bouncing back and forth between, oh, you know, like there's no way the Oklahoma City Thunder can match the Warriors. Oh, my goodness, there's no way. You know, we talked, whatever it was, 2 weeks ago, Neil, about how going into that fourth quarter of Game 6, Oklahoma City had a 96% chance to win that series. It's almost like at this point in the NBA postseason, like although there's been all of this randomness, the only thing that's held true is the teams that were the best during the regular season seem to have eventually advanced, even if it's by, you know, the skin of their teeth. Wow, I just used a horrible cliche. So now I'm like, well, look, you have to look at the Golden State Warriors and be like, okay, these were the pieces they were missing. Does it feel like this is still their championship?
Yeah, I look at it as it's hard enough to beat Golden State one time. They only lost nine times between October and the end of April, you know? It's hard enough to do that once. Now, it's hard enough to beat them back-to-back. Now, granted, Oklahoma City did that, But, you know, you're asking lightning to strike in the bottle twice. But
right.
If that lightning bolt is LeBron James, man, you always got a chance. So this is my personal opinion. You two do not have to agree with me. If Cleveland if Cleveland can win game six, I think they win the series.
Okay, well, you heard it here. We've got a Warriors prediction and we've got a Cavs prediction. I'd probably still lean toward the Warriors. I do think that's kind of the most likely outcome. But man, wouldn't it be something if Cleveland broke their championship drought? In any event, let's leave it there. We'll be back next week to unpack whatever happens over the next two games. Game 7, if it does happen, would be Sunday. And so we'll be back here next Tuesday to talk about it again. All right, we're going to say goodbye to Justin briefly as we talk hockey. He's off skating elsewhere, but he'll skate his way back over to us. And speaking of skating, after months of doing that, plus some hitting, plus a lot of beard growing, the Pittsburgh Penguins are your 2016 Stanley Cup champions. To help us put a bow on the season and look forward to the next one, we welcome back Hot Takedown's official hockey correspondent, Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post. Neil, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. How's everybody doing?
Doing good.
Doing real good.
Real good.
You got your playoff beard shaved off?
Actually, yes. I always think about that during the playoffs. Like, I would love to one year just, like, time it where I, like, shave the last time on, like, the day before the playoffs start. And then, you know, not like, follow hockey, but not even follow it that religiously. But just, like, if people ask me why I'm having, you know, so much facial hair, I just say playoff beard and then see how where that gets me.
See, I tried that here at work. Like, I was growing a playoff beard until my editor actually asked me, what's happening over here? And, like, was motioning to his own face. And I was like, you know what, maybe I should just maybe it's not working out the way that I had planned.
Further proof we're not real hockey players, sadly.
Right.
So let's talk about the actual results on the ice. And again, the Penguins won. Oftentimes, we talk about hockey as being one of the most, if not the most, random of the, you know, big four sports here in North America. But did this time the best? It sounded like the best team won. We went on with you a couple weeks ago, and you were singing the praises of the Pittsburgh Penguins and their advanced stats.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. It's the goal scoring part of it is pretty random. However, the puck possession element is reliable. And what we found over the past couple years, over the past 11 years actually, is that a team that's in the top three for a puck possession metric we call Corsi, which is simply the percentage of all shots that go in a team's favor during even strength, when you adjust that number for score effects, and you look at the top three, one of those has won the cup in 9 of the past 11 years. So it's an extremely good leading indicator of what team should have success. Pittsburgh ranked number 2 during the season, and they were my pre-playoff pick to win, and they happened to oblige. But it's clearly a case of the better team winning. It was, even though the Capitals probably had the better, more traditional stats in terms of wins and losses, they didn't have the puck possession underpinnings that Pittsburgh had, and they absolutely crushed San Jose in that regard. San Jose had a lot of trouble dealing with Pittsburgh, both at even strength and on special teams. So, yeah, it's not a surprising result, but it was definitely – the only surprising thing for me was that it took 6 games. I thought Penguins would win in 5.
Okay, so Hockey Neil, I'm wondering, because now that the Pittsburgh has won one Stanley Cup, meaning in a row, the question then turns to where we think the possibilities lie for them next year. I'm wondering what you think is kind of the biggest threat for them, whether it's a team or whether, you know, news coming out today that NHL and Vegas are going to partner here and give Vegas their first pro team. Seems like that would affect Pittsburgh, especially when you look at only being able to protect one goalie, and now they've got Matt Murray plus Fleury. Who do they protect? Obviously, I would think you would protect the young guy. But what do you think when you take in all those factors of expansion being a factor in whether or not Pittsburgh can repeat, as well as like what team can challenge them next year?
Yeah, it's going to be tough for any hockey team to repeat. We haven't had a repeat champion in quite some time. As for the expansion draft, I agree with you. Marc-Andre Fleury is probably going to be the casualty there. You know, Matt Murray showed that he's more than capable of backstopping a cup-caliber team. He's way cheaper than Marc-Andre Fleury is, and Fleury's on the wrong side of 30 years old. That usually spells a pretty quick decline for goalies. So I think that in terms of who the Penguins are going to lose in the draft, it probably is going to be Marc-Andre Fleury, or at the very least, he's going to be exposed to the draft. And what's interesting about Pittsburgh, and we see this in all sports, and we see this after any champion wins the title, it becomes a copycat league, and teams will try to do what Pittsburgh Penguins did to win the cup. However, like we discussed earlier, number one, they were a very good puck possession team, and number two, they were a very speedy team. So they were able to get through the neutral zone. They did a great job once Mike Sullivan took over as head coach earlier in the year of carrying the puck into the zone, not dumping the puck in as much as maybe you see some other teams, and they had a really strong depth at forward that caused other teams problems. And I'm not quite sure that that's able to be reproduced very quickly, especially in the span of an offseason when higher caliber players aren't usually available in free agency, and we certainly aren't going to have a good free agent class this year. So it's quite possible that they're going to be able to repeat. I know there were some early odds makers that came out and had them at least the second choice behind the Chicago Blackhawks. And, you know, Pittsburgh was kind of built in the mode of the Chicago Blackhawks in terms of prioritizing skating ability, puck handling, things of that nature. So there certainly should be on anybody's short list. Injuries obviously will play a role, but I think that they are certainly going to be tough to beat again next year. And there's nothing that they did this year, and there's nothing in the way that they're built or their age or anything like that suggests they're going to have such a severe downturn next year, or that it was so unsustainable this year that they're going to run into a problem on next season.
Well, yeah, and to that point, you talked about how there hadn't been a back-to-back champ in a while. But, Kate, what did we decide the term was for a team that won non-consecutively? Was it like a Grover Cleveland or something?
Yes, because of the nod to the presidential. Like, didn't he have – he won multiple terms, but not consecutively.
Non-consecutively had presidential terms. And the Blackhawks, you mentioned them, Neil, that they kind of had this quasi-dynasty. I guess we were trying to figure out what the definition of a dynasty was. And I was reading a story that said that Pittsburgh had a shot at a lengthy run at the top. How common are dynasties in the NHL relative to other sports? I remember the Oilers in the 80s and the Islanders before them. And then, of course, the Blackhawks, if you want to consider them a dynasty. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. But then it seems like there's kind of a gap in which there weren't many dynasties. So, yeah, I guess how does that compare to, like, the NBA where it's just all dynasties all the time?
Yeah, there's a lot more parity in the NHL, and it's because of what we talked about earlier, that goal scoring is so fluky. There's been some studies that suggest as much as two-thirds of goal scoring is actually just random luck. So it's
Ooh, boy, that's a lot.
That's a huge amount. So it's very hard to sustain that going forward, even if you do have a really good scoring team. And as far as the Blackhawks, you know, when they won last year, we were talking about what stories to do, and I was pretty adamant that they weren't a dynasty for the exact reasons that you stated, right? I mean, because to me, a dynasty is consecutive wins in a row, like the Edmonton Oilers when they had Gretzky and Messier, like the New York Islanders when they had Mike Bossy and Trottier and those guys. So there hasn't been a dynasty like that in a long time. Detroit Red Wings had some success, the New Jersey Devils had some success, but never, you know, multiple titles in a row. And then in 2005-2006, the NHL instituted the salary cap, and that really leveled the playing field among all teams. And we rarely saw a team make it to the finals 2 years in a row, let alone win, you know, come close to winning 2 years in a row. And then we had the Blackhawks, which won three, the Los Angeles Kings that won two. So I refer to them as modern-day dynasties. I mean, the Grover Clevelands is certainly a much catchier name. You should probably trademark that before someone else steals it.
If not Grover Cleveland himself or the estate of Grover Cleveland.
Certainly the Chicago Blackhawks qualify as a modern dynasty, I guess, only because it's been so hard. But every year, the recency effect, right? Every year the champion is going to be the most likely to to repeat. But in the NBA, it's a lot more palatable. But in the NHL, I would always bet against it. I would always bet on a team, another good puck possession team. And I actually had some success in this early, over a couple of years ago, which was I found out that typically good puck possession teams that are in the future odds range of like 10 to 12 to 1 are the most likely teams to win a Stanley Cup. And it allowed me to pick Chicago, but when they won their first one, and then the Kings the next year at 12 to 1, and then the Blackhawks again, they were like 10 to 1. Because typically a lot of people focus on the darlings, right? The San Jose's, the Vancouver's, the Washington Capitals of the world, but they really don't value what's important in hockey and what really points to the champions, and that's the puck possession, because that's really what's sustainable year to year. So I haven't looked yet because the odds just came out, but my guess is the Blackhawks would be a good pick. Certainly the Kings, if they can figure out a way to translate their massive puck possession edge into goals scored, even just a little bit, I think that they would absolutely decimate the National Hockey League, even more so than we saw the Capitals this year. So it's teams like that for me would be a better bet alongside the Penguins. Not that I would dismiss the Penguins out of hand, but very difficult to repeat in today's NHL.
Okay, Neil. So one more question, and this goes back to what Kate was saying about expansion. Again, the news came out today that the NHL was expanding again, and it made me think about in the 90s that the complaint was always that the league expanded too much too quickly and kind of diluted the talent pool. Do you think now is the right time for expansion? Has the talent pool finally caught up to the point that we actually do need a new NHL team?
No, I don't think so. I think it's way more about the $500 million franchise fee that the owners are going to get to split. Think about where they're putting the team. They're putting the team in Las Vegas that has hundreds of different options at night to do stuff, right? Not even including gambling. You have all the shows, sightseeing, everything like that. And then you talk about a transient town, so it's going to be very difficult for them to create a fan base. You have the most of the population works in the casinos, and most of that work is done at night when the games are going on. So it's for me, it's more of a money play than anything. However, what it seems like they're doing in terms of the rules, like in terms of how you can, what players you need to protect and how many you can protect and that sort of thing, it certainly looks like they're trying to make it so that if it is indeed Vegas as the expansion team, they can be very competitive out of the gate, especially on the defensive side, because you can only choose to keep three defensemen. So that's going to put a lot of fourth and fifth defensemen out on the wire, and those can typically be decent defensemen, way better than something you'd get in a multi-team expansion draft. So, no, I don't think the talent pool is there to sustain another team, but it certainly looks like the NHL Board of Governors is trying to make it so that there can be some decent players in terms of the expansion draft. And we just talked about one, right? Marc-Andre Fleury. I mean, he's a legitimate NHL goalie, and if he is indeed exposed and picked up, well, that's a decent cornerstone for an expansion team to at least use as a stopgap until they can draft someone and get them going, like we saw with Pittsburgh with Matt Murray, or even the Capitals with Braden Holtby, or some of the younger goaltenders that are out there. But I don't think that this is anything more than a financial grab, because look, ice hockey does not work in the hot desert. It just doesn't. And you couple that with everything else that's going on in Vegas, I just think it's going to be hard to get any sort of loyal fan base over a significant period of time. But the teams will be more competitive than we've seen in past expansions.
All right. Well, thanks, Neil, for coming on again. You can read Neil's work at the Washington Post's Fancy Stats blog. And we'll flip on the puck signal again and have you on again the next time we need to talk about hockey.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Hockey Neil.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on and welcome back Justin. He's been off skating around as we've been talking about hockey, but he's back now to talk about something that he wrote about at The Undefeated this week. In 1971, the Howard University soccer team became the first historically black college to win a Division I NCAA championship. But a year later, the NCAA took their title away. Why? Justin wrote about the reasons for The Undefeated, but before we go to him, let's hear a clip from the accompanying film produced by Spike Lee.
It was just after what many would call the apex of the civil rights movement. 2 years absent from when Martin Luther King was killed. Howard University at the time was representative of the very best of the Black Power movement. The soccer team was a microcosm of that.
It really is stepping into a cauldron of civil rights. We came from different countries, and for that group of players, those were not our experiences. We were now experiencing those things really for the first time. So for any young man to come to Washington from Trinidad, everything that we saw on our one channel in Trinidad and Tobago television was now unfolding right at our doorstep.
So, Justin, first up, what happened? Why did the NCAA strip Howard of the title?
What happened was they had just won the championship, I believe, New Year's Eve 1971, so heading into 1972. They received a letter from President Richard Nixon at the time congratulating them and eventually inviting them to the White House later that year. So they're on cloud nine. They're the first HBCU Division I national champions in any sport, and something happened a couple of weeks later. The NCAA received an anonymous letter saying, I think you need to look into this team here at Howard University. They're a team full of foreign-born players, and I don't, pretty much saying he didn't, that person didn't believe they went to class, and they were just hired gunners. One thing led to another. It's like a snowball rolling downhill effect. And honestly, man, in college sports, if you go looking for something long enough, you're going to find something, you know, because especially back then, this is before the internet, before online fouling, fouls get lost, this, that, and the third. And so what eventually happened is Howard was charged with three different infractions. One was called the foreign student rule. One was called the 5-year rule. And the other was called the 1.6 rule. The 1.6 rule was really the one that kind of like, perturbed Howard and eventually, you know, other conferences a lot, because the Ivy League tried to get the 1.6 rule abolished 5 years before Howard got caught up in it. And pretty much what it was saying is, coming out of high school, you have to predict a 1.6 GPA. You know, you got to take your SATs or your ACTs. And a lot of these guys were coming from, you know, Nigeria, Trinidad and Tobago, where, you know, they didn't take the SAT and, those type of tests over there. But they took the equivalent in their country and they passed. And, you know, these guys had passing grades at Howard. You know, at one point before Howard won the 1971 NCAA championship, they had the highest GPA of any athletic program on campus at Howard. So it wasn't like these guys were just playing soccer and not going to class. But Howard tried to fight it in the courtroom, but eventually the courts ruled in favor of the NCAA. And over the course of the 1972 season, when they were looking to repeat as champions, because at that point they hadn't yet got their title stripped away. Guys on the team just started sitting out because they were ruled ineligible by the NCAA, and they made it all the way back to the Final Four with pretty much a depleted team. We were just talking about the Cavaliers last year. Imagine that times 20, but they didn't have a LeBron on their team in the Final Four, you know? So literally a couple of days after they were eliminated in 1972, that's when they had their title stripped, and that's when they were banned from postseason play in 1974. And honestly, one of the more intriguing and frustrating thoughts about the entire process is, who knows where Howard University soccer program could be today if they were allowed to flourish in the dynasty that they should have been. They came in third place in 1970. They won in 1971. They made it all the way back to the Final Four with a depleted team in 72. They were banned from competition in 73. And thankfully, the story did have a happy ending. They won it again in 1974. But when you talk to the guys on the team and some of the coaches, they're always wondering, like, okay, what if? And not to go overboard, not to talk too much about this, but the coaches, Lincoln Phillips, he was the head coach of the soccer team then, legendary soccer coach at Howard. You can tell he felt terrible about what happened. Not really more so with him, but more so for his players. He says it repeatedly. He's like, look, man, I'm not a cheater. This is we have been abiding by these rules the entire time I was here, and it was never an issue until, you know, we became the powerhouse that we became. He's like, I wasn't trying to cheat anybody. You know, other coaches verified him at the time, too. You know, other coaches spoke highly of his character, but it was just one anonymous letter led to the entire operation burning to the ground.
One thing that I wanted to ask about is I got the sense that it was pretty unusual for the NCAA to just outright strip a team of a title at that moment in time, even though, you know, we remember USC getting stripped of it about 10 years ago. But is that true that at that time it was kind of unheard of, right?
I thumbed through all the NCAA record books, and I did not see an instance of a title being stripped until this Howard team in 1971.
Wow.
Yeah, so as far, to my knowledge, they are the first team to ever be stripped of a national championship.
Well, Justin, I'm wondering, in your mind, as you reported and wrote this piece, how much of the stripping of their NCAA title was in some way, whether out overtly or coded, racially motivated? I mean, I just from at first glance hearing you talk about it, I have to think if you're basing something on the SAT, ACTs, like that, there's a test right there that has been proven to have certain racial biases, especially then when you're administering it or trying to come up with some comparable for guys who are foreign born. As you reported, I guess, did you think that any of this was racially motivated, even if it wasn't in an overt way?
You know, at first I thought it was really racially motivated by the NCAA's decision. I was like, oh man, the NCAA is practicing racism, you know, this, that, and the third. But then the more I looked into it, I don't think it was more so racially motivated on the NCAA's part. I think whoever sent that anonymous letter, that was racially motivated, you know, because there's an actual quote in the story, and right now I can't recall the guy's name to save my life, but he was the head coach at Navy at the time, who was also a powerhouse in the area in soccer. And he had a quote, and I hate quoting somebody, and I had a quote in front of me, but he said something to the extent where, I don't think all those guys should be on the team. Now, that you know, you can read between the lines, you can kind of, you know, pick up on context clues, but there was animosity towards other teams in the league at that point in time that Howard played. So maybe whoever sent that letter, I believe that was racially motivated. Now, the NCAA, I don't want to say they were necessarily racially motivated in their decision, other than the courts just followed the rule book at the time. But I do believe that the 1.6 rule did have, you just mentioned it, did have implications of, you know, veiled amounts of racism, because the SAT, ACT, we know about the you know, the stereotypes with those tests going in. And a lot of those guys, they weren't prepared to take the SAT or the ACT.
One thing, yeah, I really wanted to talk about this 1.6 rule, because the thing that stood out to me in your story when you describe it is that it wasn't even about looking at what a person actually did in the classroom. It was about predicting whether they could maintain a level of a 1.6 GPA. Do you have any idea how they tried to do that, or what went into that, and how was there any way that you could even look at, like, what is a 1.6 GPA across different colleges? It seems like the standards are kind of hopelessly different at different schools, and that it just seems like such an arbitrary, you know, standard to hold everyone to.
It was. And, you know, the more and more you read about the 1.6 rule, it honestly becomes more confusing. Like, it got to a point in the research process where I was just like, all right, I got to step away from this, because I thought I understood what the rule was, but how do you predict the 1.6 GPA? You got your test scores, you got your transcript. What more do you need? And that was part of the reason why the Ivy League didn't like it, because it was so vague. And to be ironically, man, the 1.6 rule was repealed in 1973, but it wouldn't go effect until the 1974-75 school year. So one of the three main infractions that Howard was pretty much convicted of was eventually repealed, but they were still punished for it. You know, like, these guys, a lot of these guys still work in D.C. A lot of them are, you know, entrepreneurs. A lot of them are lawyers. So, like, these dentists, a lot of they weren't hired gunners. And I think that more than even stripping them of the title in 1971, because they said repeatedly, excuse me, that, you know, you can do whatever. You can't strip our memories from us. Like, we know we won that title legit, and you can't take that from us. But what hurt was trying to label them as pretty much dumb jocks, dumb international jocks. We said, no, we came here for school. A lot of those guys didn't even know Howard had a soccer team when they came there. You know, they just picked it up, and they said, oh, well, I played soccer in, you know, my home country, so let me pick it up here. So the 1.6 rule, when you mention it to those guys, man, they're like, one, they didn't know what it was, but once you, you know, explain it to them, they had some colorful language about that. I can't say it on air, but it really hurt them, because once that rule was repealed in 1973, that's when it went to the 2.0 GPA. What'd you get in high school? Okay, now you can do that. It's the rule we kind of are familiar with now. So they were upset because, you know, they were persecuted for something that was eventually ruled, you know, asinine in a sense.
Yeah, and one of the other things that jumped out to me as soon as I was reading your story and reading about that 1.6 rule is the academic progress rate that the NCAA uses today, this idea of, you know, making sure that schools kind of meet these, again, arbitrary thresholds of graduation rates that we had someone come on the show for a SIG dig sometime in December, I want to say, and they talked about how even now historical black colleges are actually being hurt disproportionately by this NCAA academic progress rule, even in 2016. So it is kind of interesting how, you know, the more things change, the more, in some ways, sadly, they've stayed the same.
When it comes to HBCUs and when they're hit with like NCAA infractions, they feel it more than most other schools, because for one, they don't receive as much funding as, you know, the bigger, you know, ACC, SEC schools. So when they get hit with infractions, it really hurts and it sets them back. So yeah, like you said, man, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Okay, thanks, Justin. You can read Justin's piece at The Undefeated. It's called A Champion Dethroned. And you should also look at Spike Lee's film about the story of the 1971 Howard soccer team called Redemption Song. So now, this is the point in the show where we talk about the SIG dig. Someone brings us a telling number from the world in sports. And since we have a hot takedown newbie on, we thought, why not ask Justin? Justin, what do you got for us?
All right. I want to preface this by saying I like baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. I'm trying to get more and more into it as the seasons go by. But so forgive me if this is a common stat. So I want both of y'all to forgive me beforehand. But it's actually three numbers. It's 324, 5,714, and zero. Those all relate to Nolan Ryan. That is the number of wins he had is 324. The number of batters he struck out, 5,714. And zero is the one that really got me. I did not know Nolan Ryan did not win a single Cy Young in his career. I would have figured he had at least three or four.
Whoa. Wow. Did you know that, Kate?
No, I had no clue. I figured he would have won like three.
Yeah, me too. Same here. Yeah. Wow, that's really weird. I'm furiously pulling up his baseball reference page right now.
The best he came in was second in the Cy Young, maybe a couple of years, maybe like two or three years. But yeah, he never won a Cy Young. That tripped me out. So when you think about it, like basketball fans complain that, like, you know, Kobe only got one MVP or Shaq only got one MVP. I think the more telling stat is that Nolan Ryan never won a Cy Young.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder why that is. I bet it's because he pitched for teams, as a general rule, that were not super great. So his one-loss record wasn't all that great. I mean, he won 324 games, but he also lost 292 and won about 52.6% of his career games. So maybe for him it was just longevity. I mean, he pitched 27 years. That's a hell of a long time to be a major league pitcher. But maybe in none of those individual years, it looks like he only won 20 games twice, which is kind of the standard, especially in his era, before we started talking about FIP and WAR and things like that, that you would kind of have to hit to be in that conversation.
It serves as a reminder of how highly we seem to value things like MVPs and titles as a player's career is happening. But when you remove yourself by like 20 years, like we are from Nolan Ryan's career, like that's not really necessarily how we're judging him anymore. I mean, no. I think we've become a little more obsessive over titles and rings and hardware than we necessarily were in the 70s and 80s. But still, I think when we judge guys, we kind of judge them in the end by the energy that we've thought of them as. Like Nolan Ryan, we're like, oh, he's this hardball thrower. And he's like, you know, he's like this pitcher who just had such longevity. And that's how we remember him. We're not like, the first thing we say isn't, remember how he won no Cy Youngs?
When I think of Nolan Ryan, like you said, I think of the hardball pitcher and I think of him like hitting the guy on the head multiple times in that bench clearing brawl. Well, so yeah, that's my SIG dig, man. Hopefully it met both of you guys' approval.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. First of all, the more baseball we can get on the show is fine by me. And also, yeah, it's rare that we have a SIG dig where it's just like, shocked both of us, and we thought that we knew a factoid about history, but didn't actually.
No, I didn't know where it was going. I think overall, Justin, I think that you've really solidified your place as the permanent replacement for Chad. So.
that was on my mind the entire show. That was literally on my mind.
All right. So we'll be seeing you next week then, Justin. And in the meantime, that'll do it for this week's show. Want to say thanks again to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad. Thanks, Neil.
Oh, yeah. See, you caught yourself. I want to say thanks especially to Justin Tinsley for making his debut. Great debut, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I can't wait to come back on here and chop it up with you guys.
Our podcast producer today was Joe Sykes. Our podcast, Lord Paramount, is Jody Avergan. We receive production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Please subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song today was by Mystery Mansion, as always. I'm Neil Payne. Talk to you next time.